All right, everybody, we are back. So, you know me. I've had on a lot of great guests. We've had on, Bill O'Reilly multiple times, Tucker Carlson, just about everybody from Fox, Bill Maher even though I fought with Bill Maher. Anyway, my next guest, I rarely do this, but my next guest is a must listen. If you're near work or you're near home, tell the wife that you need an extra 15, 20 minutes because my next guest is worth the wait. Dr. Thomas Kranawitter. He holds a PhD in political science from the Claremont Graduate University, specializing in American political thought and classical political philosophy. He has written books including Lincoln and Liberty, Crisis of Our House Divided, Vindicating Lincoln, Save the Swamp, Challenges to the American Founding, and A Nation Under God. Kranawitter has been a political science professor at various colleges and universities throughout his career, including Colorado Christian University, Hillsdale College, Claremont McKenna College, George Mason University. He's a top influencer and a principal instructor for the leadership program of the Rockies. I'm exhausted with your intro, Tom. I appreciate you, man, coming on. Honestly, it means a lot to me that you're coming on today to talk to everybody. As I sat in a class that you were instructing, I just kept sitting there and thinking to myself, my listeners have to hear this guy. So, Doc, thank you for coming on. I appreciate it.
Hey, it's great to be here, Lee. That was kind of fun in that presentation. I introduced the subject, property rights. I think a lot of people thought this is going to be a real yawner.
Right.
And by the end of the seminar, people are like standing up and cheering and hooting.
Well, because people don't realize the intricacies of all of that and how everything is intertwined together. And you really make it easy to listen to it. And I want to bounce around on a number of different topics, but I also want to tell everybody, you've got a website at vinoandveritassociety.com, and we can spell it out. It's VINOANDVERITAS Society, SOCIET.com. And if you go to that, what is that so everybody knows?
Yeah, so Vino and Veritas Society is really the product of my 30 years that I have spent in the trenches of the conservative movement. I'm a Claremont guy. I'm a Hillsdale guy. I had research fellowships at the Heritage Foundation. I know all the guys at the National Review. Those are sort of my orbits over the last three decades. And in recent years, I have stepped back, and I've taken a really hard, critical look at the modern conservative movement. The conservative movement is now about eight decades old. It stretches all the way back to the 1940s, to the New Deal, reactions against FDR and his New Deal. And in those 80 years, there have been a lot of smart and talented people within the conservative movement, going all the way back to the 1940s, 1950s, guys like von Mises. He was an economist. Friedrich Hayek, they were writing books. A guy named William Buckley Jr. launched a big national magazine, National Review. They started creating think tanks and publishing books and magazines. In 1980, they elected a president, Ronald Reagan. In 1987, Congress repealed the Fairness Doctrine so that programs like this could take off. There could be open talk radio, and a guy named Rush Limbaugh blazed a trail, right, and gained this huge national following. So the point is, it's not like conservatives have been lazy, although they've been doing a lot. The problem is, in all those eight decades, progressivism has been gaining steam. It has been progressive government has been expanding by every metric imaginable. Our culture has become increasingly progressive. Progressivism is taking over entertainment, is taking over the halls of education. And so I step back and say, wait, we constitutionalists, we who care about preserving our constitutional republic, we're losing badly. And we still show up at big dinners and galas, and we give each other awards, and we compliment each other, but we're not winning the fight. Progressivism is winning the fight. And I wanted to do something different, start thinking out of the box. And I was reminded of that famous conclusion of the Declaration of Independence. You remember those guys are standing around, There's about three dozen of them in a room, and they have produced this document, and they know that if they attach their names to that document, that is treason.
Right.
From the point of view of the British government, they are committing treason. They could be executed. And so this was dead serious stuff. Are we really declaring our independence from the British government? And they're looking at each other in the eye, and the document ends with a pledge to each other. They pledged their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor, everything that they had. And each of them, right, was thinking, okay, I'm in. I think I'm in. If you're in, are you really in, right? And the point is, the revolution was launched out of trust. There was a kind of deep civic trust and friendship there. Strangers don't make those kinds of pledges to each other. And the challenge we have today, we have good, patriotic lovers of the Constitution, lovers of freedom scattered across the country, but they tend not to know each other.
Right.
They sit at home, they listen to their favorite podcasts, they watch Fox News, they read the editorial page of the Wall Street Journal, they get angry, but they're not communicating with others. They're not deepening their own understanding of these ideas. They're not becoming more persuasive or better communicators. They don't have a network of friends to go take actions. And that's why I created the Vino and Veritas Society. The idea is there's Veritas. So there's a lot of content there for Americans who want to know more about their country. But the Vino represents, getting together and having a glass of wine, breaking bread, spending time with each other, actually getting to know and trust one another. That is sorely lacking among conservatives today, and that's what I'm trying to do with the Vino and Veritas Society, is provide a platform for patriots to get to know each other as they get to know their country better.
So is it a back and forth as it happens real time on the website?
Some of it is, yeah. There's actually a society part of the website. When you join, you log in, and that you're going to see lots of other members are in there, and people are communicating with each other. They're planning with each other. And then some of our members are creating chapters, and they meet. Some meet once a week. Some meet once a month. It's sort of up to the people in the chapter how they want to run it. And we produce an enormous amount of content that our chapters, we encourage our chapters, use the content. Every month, for example, we produce a big case study. We produce our own podcasts that are for our members, and we encourage them to talk about these things. Because, Lee, I've realized this after 30 years of teaching and writing and scholarship and research, when it comes to fundamental moral and political ideas that pertain to justice, to what's right and what's wrong, to the proper purpose of government, these kinds of core ideas, they don't just easily sink in. You typically, most people need more than to just hear a lecture or read an article. It really helps to talk about these things, bounce them back and forth. What about this? What about in that situation? What does this principle mean, for these particular situations? And in having those conversations, people get to understand these ideas better. And there's something else that happens, a wonderful little byproduct. As people talk about these core ideas, what is property, what is liberty, what is law, what should law be, as they talk about these things, they become better communicators of them. They come to articulate them better, more succinctly, more persuasively, which makes them little engines for liberty, spreaders of the ideas of liberty. And so that's all part of what we're trying to accomplish in the Vino and Veritas Society. I encourage your listeners to check it out.
Yeah, the best college classes that I ever took were the ones that you made a semicircle and just talked it out, right, back and forth. Those are the best to me.
Absolutely.
You mentioned, and I wanted to start someplace else, but since you mentioned this, we'll go over here for a second, because you mentioned progressives are winning, and they do seem like they are winning, and we need to fight that fight. How much damage has the academic community done to this country, in your mind?
Tremendous damage. To the point, I say that I'm a scholar of politics and history, so I don't say this lightly. This is not a little throwaway line. I really mean this. America today, in many ways, is more German than it is American. Huh. It's more Russian than it is American. And what I mean by that is, at the end of the 19th century, so if we go back to that period around the 1880s, 1890s, very early 1900s, the German universities were the home of a new kind of social science. And it was a social science that was enamored with the idea of progress, with the idea of bureaucracy, with the idea of scientific expertise. Remember, you know, think about that period, the late 1800s. This is coming off of, you know, a century and a half, two centuries of the Enlightenment, right? Modern science, modern technology has really transformed the world, made communication easier, transportation easier, growing food, building houses. Everything seemed to be getting better because science was producing all this great technology. And in the German universities, a handful of scholarly minds start to think about, well, what if we applied scientific technology to entire societies? What if we looked at society as something to be engineered, to be planned? Just like you engineer a steam engine, why can't we engineer a society? And we'll have scientific experts, and we'll put them in bureaus so that they don't have to be accountable to the elected, ignorant many. They can sit in their bureaus, their bureaucracies, and issue regulations and control our lives. That set of ideas emerged from German universities, and it attracted the attention of young American academics, many of whom went to Europe. They went to Germany, got their PhDs, and came back and created the first graduate programs in the social sciences here in the United States. A guy named John Burgess he went to the University of Berlin, got his PhD, came back, created the first graduate program in political science. This was at the University of Columbia, and then some of his students started a second graduate program at Johns Hopkins, and one of their first students was a fellow named Woodrow Wilson, who gets his PhD in this very modern, Germanic, bureaucratic, political science, and of course, he's going to get elected president of the United States, not once, but two times. And so the institutions of higher education have been the primary vehicle by which these ideas of collectivism, of central planning, of government by bureaucratic expertise replacing self-government, these ideas have emerged and been communicated through the universities and very efficiently, very effectively, because when you think about what a university is, it's a collection of the most gullible human beings in the world, right? 18-year-olds and 19-year-olds and 20-year-olds. And the whole progressive idea, they designed the modern research university so that it's virtually impenetrable to outside influences. And meanwhile, they take all these gullible students and they surround them with progressivism, right? So a typical progressive university, the students are getting progressivism in their English literature classes, and they're getting it in philosophy, and they're getting it in their econ classes, right? It doesn't matter. You can go in and take a course in the sciences, right? And you're going to learn the progressive view of global warming and what to do about that. And so it's no doubt when conservatives complain, when they say, man, why are universities so progressive? I say, because they were designed to be that way. That's precisely what they were designed to be. And from the university, think of all the influencers who come from the university. Our teachers, everyone who teaches in K-12, where do they get educated? They get educated in universities. The political class, the C class, and the business corporate boardrooms, where do they get educated? They go to the university. And so I put a lot of blame. It's one of the reasons, as a PhD myself, I often apologize for my degree. I mean, it was a lot of work to get it, but I'm acutely aware of the damage to liberty that has been caused by the class of PhDs.
Dr. Thomas Kranawitter is our guest. I told you this was going to be a great segment, and he always delivers. He's the founder of the Vino in Veritas Society. You got to go online, check that out. One more time, I want to spell it out for you so you don't mistake it.
VinoVerititasSocieT. Did I say why? Why? .com. Let me throw this to you because every question that I ask you, this is what's really remarkable about you, is that you could go on for a half hour, and I love that, and sort of everybody hangs on every word. So I want to pick my questions carefully because I know we don't have a lot of time, and I do eventually. I don't know if we're going to have time to get into it today / tonight, but I do want to have that conversation about slavery. That's like a segment all on its own. Because the way you've broken that down and the way you explain that is unlike anybody else I've ever heard in my life. But we like to think of ourselves as a nation that adheres to the written word of our Constitution, right? So we say that we abide by the Constitution. However, in the speech that you gave to the Centennial Institute, you eloquently stated, "An apathetic, disinterested America, which is allowing our government to routinely violate great swaths of the Constitution." How can people, us, all of us, allow the government to ignore certain parts of the Constitution but uphold some of the other parts of it?
Well, I like to remind fellow Americans who care about constitutional government. And, you know, we should probably say a word about that. Why? Why should anybody care about constitutional government? Here's the answer. Because governments are inherently dangerous. All governments are potentially dangerous. In fact, they're not just a danger. Government is the greatest man-made danger to human beings. And I mean that statistically. I can prove that. When you look throughout history, governments very often will turn on their own people. There's an entire discipline within my academic field of study, political science. There's a sub-discipline called democide. Democide is the study of governments slaughtering their own people. So we're not even talking about like governments killing citizens of other countries in war. We're talking about Cambodia creating, you know, their killing fields. We're talking about the death camps that Germany builds and sends German citizens to. We're talking about governments that slaughter their own people, and the numbers go up into the hundreds of millions of human souls who have been exterminated by their own governments, many of whom thought right up to the last minute, this is going to work out okay because this is my government. I'm sure they're really not going to hurt me until lights out. So I mentioned that because that's why governments are always dangerous. This is a summary, but it's also true. A government is the ultimate monopoly because it's a monopoly on legalized force. Right, Lee, you and I can use force. We can go out in the street and push someone, punch someone, right? Point a gun at someone. But when we do that, we're doing that in violation of the law. The law is going to come after us and arrest us for those acts. When government does it, government is doing it with the backing of law. It's legalized force. And that kind of power is always tempting to abuse and to misuse. And that's why when we create a government, if we're wise, if we're smart, we limit its power by writing a constitution. And one of the most alarming things to us should be if our government ever tries to exercise powers that we, the people, did not grant to it in the Constitution. What's terrifying today is the fact that our government exercises powers not delegated to it by the Constitution routinely, all the time. There are a few parts of the Constitution that we seem to follow. The Constitution calls for elections, for example, you know, representatives and senators and presidents. And there's a process for judges, you know, being added to the Supreme Court. We're seeing confirmation hearings right now as a part of that process. Those parts of the Constitution are obeyed. But there are the huge swaths that we ignore are the few enumerated powers that we grant to our government, and they simply ignore it. They go and do things like they create regulatory agencies, not dozens of them, not hundreds of them, thousands of them, that are staffed by literally millions of unelected bureaucrats who are given the power by Congress. They're given the power to issue and enforce regulations as if these regulations are laws. I always joke in class about, you know, I say we all know what a law is because we all watched Schoolhouse Rock when we were kids.
That's right.
There's that great little, you know, that little video cartoon of how a bill becomes a law. I'm just a bill, right, sitting here on Capitol Hill. And what is supposed to happen for something to become a law? Both chambers of Congress vote and approve it, and then typically it is signed into law by a president. Well, that doesn't happen with a regulation, and yet the regulation is treated as if it's law. If you violate a regulation, you can be arrested, you can be drugged before a judge in a court, you can be fined, you can have your business shut down, you can be put in prison for violating regulations that aren't actually laws. So yeah, this is just one example of these huge areas that we've simply abandoned constitutional government to the point, I think for many Americans, probably many of your listeners right now, I suspect many of them, if they saw an image of what real constitutional government looked like, not this big, huge bureaucracy, not all these regulatory agencies, but just a Congress, right, and a president and a Supreme Court and maybe a few support staff to help them, and that's it. Because they become so dependent, it scares most Americans. Because they become so dependent, the existence of this big bureaucratic state makes them feel comfortable, and that's one of our great challenges. If we really want constitutional government, and this goes back to the reason I founded the Vino and Veritas Society, if we really want constitutional government, the first thing that has to happen is a change in our culture, a change in our character. We have to become citizens who are willing to stand up and be independent, mature, responsible adults and make our own choices and accept the consequences of our choices and help those that we love, help each other out, and not be so dependent on a bureaucracy that says, we're going to keep you safe from all potential harms if you just give up your liberty and your property and turn it over to us.
So technically, where we are right now, today, we're further away from the actual Constitution than we've ever been, and it continues down that road like a ripple in a pond effect. We just keep getting further and further and further and further away from what the Founding Fathers intended, correct?
That's right, and that means we are. Every year that goes by right now, and you know, I want to make a sort of a political and partisan point about this. This has been the case, this trajectory away from constitutional government has been going on now for basically a century, the better part of a century. And that means that's been happening under both Republican and Democratic administrations. It's been happening under Republican and Democratic Congresses. It tends to happen, the growth of the unconstitutional administrative state usually is a little slower under Republicans than it is under Democrats. But this problem very much is a bipartisan problem. We don't really have a constitutional government or a constitutional party. We have a Republican Party that talks a lot about constitutional government. And the problem is very many of them, once they get elected and they get into office, they start seeing that acting unconstitutionally benefits them in so many ways, and it's so tempting.
So I got to ask you this on top of this. We're talking again to Professor Kranowitter. We appreciate Thomas Kranowitter, who is he's actually teaching a class that I'm a part of, and I want to finish up with that and get to that in a second. But is where we are now with 350 million people, I mean, we're bigger now than we ever were. So yeah. The Founding Five, we get bigger every day. Can the document that we're talking about provide for essentially 500 million people pretty soon the way it provided for 2.5 million people, let's say, in 1776?
Man, it's a great question. And the answer, this might startle some people listening. The answer is yes, it can. Yes, it can. But there's one really important qualifier, one really important premise And that premise is we have to lower our expectation of what government should do. The point of view of the founders, and I think they were right about, they were dead on right. Remember, the American founding happens after centuries of terrible, bloody, often religious war in Europe. And then, of course, the founders were very aware of that. They were deeply schooled in history. They knew all of that. They knew the terrible history of religious persecution and the great wars that it often triggered. And so one of the primary ideas in the American founding is let's lower the goal of government, the purpose of government, to something it can achieve, something it can do well, and that is protect the individual liberty, protect the property of each and every citizen. That's what government should do, and that's it. Government is not going to be in the business of saving souls, for example. It's not going to decide what religious beliefs or religious practices you or I should engage in. Government's not going to be Santa Claus. Government is not going to be a provider. It's not there to hand out things to people, to give houses and education and health care to people who want it, or in many cases, to people who don't want it. The purpose of government should be very limited. Make sure that every citizen is secure in their person, in their property, and can live the kind of life that they want to live. And then what individuals make of their own life, that's kind of up to them.
Right.
It depends on them. Of course, there's always chance, right? Like bad things sometimes happen. It's going to depend on what kind of relationships you cultivate with your family, with your friends, what kind of support network you have. But it's really up to us. It's not up to government to set a way of life for the people. Now, if we could lower our expectations of government, which also means we have to elevate, we have to raise our expectations of ourselves. We gotta look at ourselves and say, wow, I have an obligation as a citizen. I have an obligation to be responsible, to be productive, to be independent and self-reliant. I have a responsibility to take care of my kids, my family, the people I care about. If we can put more expectation on ourselves, expect more from ourselves, and expect less from government, then, yeah, that Constitution actually works really, really well, because all that we really need from the federal government, the national government, is a serious institutions of national defense and national security. The world's a dangerous place. We need it. We need a Navy.
Right.
We need an Army. And then domestically, internally, a whole lot of what government should do should actually happen at the state and local level. We should have, criminal laws so that to protect us from thieves and murderers and people like that. We should have civil court systems so that, if my tree falls, under your house,
right,
Lee, and it causes damage, and that's not your fault, it's my fault, you should be able to sue me in a civil court, and I should have to, repair your roof, repair your house. If government gets scaled back to those kinds of purposes, just making sure people are safe in their life, their liberty, their pursuit of happiness, and then say, let's see what they do. Let's watch them. Then, it's actually possible for that document written in 1787 to work today.
Dr. Thomas Kranewitter, I could talk to you for hours, just scratching the surface here on what I would eventually love to talk to you on the air about, but I know we're probably past our time. And by the way, I'm going to make a lot of folks in class mad because they all sent me questions to ask you and I got to none of them. So,
we should do a quick mention of your class because it's a great organization that has been launched in Connecticut, and that's the Charter Oak Leadership Program.
Absolutely. And I was lucky enough to get involved in this, and we're closing in on graduation day for that. And, every class is an adventure in a good way, and I learn something amazing every single time. And, you're one of the great instructors. There are many that come on every single time there's a class. It's really pretty remarkable, and anybody who's lucky enough to get to be a part of that should jump at that chance. So, Doc, one more time, tell everybody the website you want them to go to learn more about In Vino and Veritas.
So it's vinoandveritassociety.com, or you can just Google Vino and Veritas Society. Vino is wine. Of course, that's the Italian word for wine. Veritas is the Latin word for truth. We are all about truth and wine, truth and socializing, truth and, you know, making friends, strengthening civic friendships, because the truth is, I think the future is going to be more difficult, not easier. I think we have some hard times in front of us, and we patriots, we constitutionalists, we who want to conserve what's best about the country, what's best about the American founding, we need to know each other. We need to be able to trust each other, and that means we got to spend some time with each other, and people can do that by going to vinoandveritassociety.com and become a member, please.
I really hope you'll come back on again and again, because I have just, like I said, scratched the surface on some of the stuff I'd love to talk to you about. Again, Dr. Krenowitter, I got something for you as we wrap this up. Are you ready to go back to 1975?
Sure, all right. Sure. 1975, okay.
Thanks, Doc.
You sure got to climb a lot of steps to get to this Capitol building here in Washington. Well, I wonder who that sad little scrap of paper is.
I'm just a bill. Yes, I'm only a bill. And I'm sitting here on Capitol Hill. Well, it's a long, long journey to the capital city. It's a long, long wait while I'm sitting in committee. But I know I'll be a law someday. At least I hope and pray that I will. But today I am still just a bill.
Gee, Bill, you certainly have a lot of patience and courage.
Well, I got this far. When I started, I wasn't even a bill. I was just an idea. Some folks back home decided they wanted a law passed, so they called their local congressman, and he said, "You're right, there ought to be a law." Then he sat down and wrote me out and introduced me to Congress, and I became a bill. And I'll remain a bill until they decide to make me a law. I'm just a bill. Yes, I'm only a bill. And I got as far as Capitol Hill. Well, now I'm stuck in committee, and I'll sit here and wait while a few key congressmen discuss and debate whether they should let me be a law. How I hope and pray that they will. But today I am still just a bill.
Listen to those congressmen arguing. Is all that discussion and debate about you?
Yeah, I'm one of the lucky ones. Most bills never even get this far. I hope they decide to report on me favorably, otherwise I may die.
Die?
Yeah, die in committee. Oh, but it looks like I'm going to live. Now I go to the House of Representatives and they vote on me.
If they vote yes, what happens?
Then I go to the Senate and the whole thing starts all over again.
Oh, no.
Oh, yes. I'm just a bill. Yes, I'm only a bill. And if they vote for me on Capitol Hill, well, then I'm off to the White House where I'll wait in a line with a lot of other bills for the president to sign. And if he signs me, then I'll be a law. How I hope and pray that he will. But today I am still just a bill.
You mean even if the whole Congress says you should be a law, the president can still say no?
Yes, that's called a veto. If the president vetoes me, I have to go back to Congress and they vote on me again, and by that time you're so old.
By that time, it's very unlikely that you become a law. It's not easy to become a law, is it?
No, but how I hope and pray that I will. But today, I am still just a bill.
He signed your bill. Now you're a law.
Oh, yes.